I'm actually going to try to motivate why it would be interesting to study open quantum systems and for looking into new ways of describing open quantum systems for applications of high-intensity X-ray interactions with matter. And the reason for doing so is basically I'm interested in trying to study quantum optics with X-rays. I would like to study nonlinear effects in the X-ray regime. I just listed here a few science drivers for the LCLS, and a lot of science drivers are actually based on linear interactions of LCLS, of X-ray field action lasers with matter. So if you think of coherent diffractive imaging, it's a purely linear effect. You can describe it by perturbation theory, the scattering effect itself. Or even if you think about time-resolved photoabsorption spectroscopy, people are interested in using XFELs for the time resolution you might have available. But if you look at applications for resonant inelastic X-ray scattering or thanes, where you study near-edge structures of solids with FELs, you even have to attenuate XFEL beams in order to limit space charge effects. So you would use the LCLS basically as a linear probe pulse, giving you a certain time resolution. Or other things like time-resolved photoelectron spectroscopy of surfaces, for instance. People want to use it in a linear way. And the same is for spectroscopy in a traditional sense of highly charged ions, for example. I think one should really look into mechanisms where you really could exploit the nonlinear effects with XFELs. And I was just putting here a few examples of, if you open up a quantum optics book, you see typical nonlinear effects in the lasing, Arabi flopping, resonance fluorescence, or resonant Raman scattering. And what I want to talk today about is a little bit how we can explore these things with atoms in the X-ray regime, and what sort of theoretical descriptions we have to have in place for studying these sort of systems. So the first thing I'm going to talk about today is studying a scheme using the XFEL to pump an atomic inertial X-ray laser. I'm cheating. I'm not using an atomic bomb to create an inertial X-ray lasing transition, but I'm using the XFEL in the very near future. And this is actually going to give you the opportunity to create very short pulses in the X-ray regime, and with the potential to produce sub-femtosecond pulses of comparable intensity to the pumping source. I'm going to talk a little bit about resonant excitations with XFELs, about Rabi flopping and the resonant Auger effect. And this should motivate something which is in close connection to resonant Raman scattering, where you would try to exploit the XFEL for Raman scattering for probing valence electron transitions in atoms. So I'm going to basically discern two different ways of interaction of XFELs with matter. We have I'm dividing it into non-resonant and resonant interactions, and I plotted here two plots representing the first two user experiments at the LCLS. The first experiment basically was I'm trying to probe neon in a non-resonant way of focusing a high-intensity XFEL beam into neon gas. And I show here basically a charged spectrum of neon at 2 keV Fulton energy. And you can see a comparison between theory and experiment, and it pretty much describes what's going on the bigger scale of the picture. The models describing these effects are basically based on perturbation theory, on single photon, single electron interactions, single ionization events of either valence electrons or core electrons. And you can describe the system by a coupled set of rate equations. where you just treat single photon ionization cross sections in these rate equations, and this describes the matter pretty well. If you go to resonant interactions of X-rays with atoms, you basically have increased coupling strength of the X-rays with your electrons due to the resonant coupling. Perturbation theory typically breaks down this scheme, and you have to describe your system by optical or generalized optical Bloch equations, basically. But what I will show you is basically that you have to treat dissipative systems and open quantum systems. So what happens if you focus the SLS beam in a gas of neon? I show here this very, very spiky SLS beam as a sample shot. You have a beam of 100 femtosecond duration. Each intensity spike of this beam has a random phase and a random amplitude. So you have this random pattern of pulses generated by the FEL. And these intensity spikes are basically that powerful that within a few femtoseconds or within the first few spikes of this XFEL beam, you can core ionize neon. So here's shown in the charge state as a function of time. So neon in the ground state. And if you go on, as a function of time, you create neon 1 plus, neon 2 plus, neon 3 plus, 4 plus, 5 plus, and so on. And if you are above all the ionization edges, what you're creating, basically, you create these higher charge states by core ionization processes. So that actually it came into my mind that you have, you're creating a population inversion by using the LCLS pulse on a very, very short time scale. And I was wondering if you could exploit this population inversion for lasing process involving inner shell transitions. So what happens here, you focus the LCLS beam, you core ionize a 1s electron within 3 femtoseconds at the given intensities. And this state actually lives only for approximately 2 femtoseconds because it's decaying via Auger decay on this time scale. If you compare the Auger decay rate to the radiative decay rate, you see that it takes 160 femtoseconds for a radiative decay to take place in this inverted state. And the question is if you could nevertheless sort of exploit the fluorescence here and try to drive a laser and amplify this spontaneous transition. For a laser, you need population inversion, but you also need a depletion of the lower lying lasing level.
That would be CW, right?
Pardon me?
CW, right?
Yeah. Basically, the lower lying laser level would be depleted by another photoionization process, which also which happens on 2 femtosecond time scale. So basically, you would have all the level kinetics are determined by ionization Auger process, and you would have an inversion which lasts only for 2-3 femtoseconds, and this gives you the possibility to actually create very, very short X-ray laser pulses. So, pardon me? So you focus basically the XFEL beam.
Is it CW or not CW?
It is not.
Well, pardon me? Well, on the time scale of the X-ray frequency, it is CW, you know, because you can put in, I don't know how many oscillations of the electromagnetic field in there.
If that's for an experimentalist, that is the pulse and not CW.
Okay, but we are talking. Okay, so I'm talking on the experimentalist terms of a theory. It should be a very easy experiment to do. So all what we need is an XFEL beam. We're focusing it into atomic gas volume. And the geometry of the laser basically is given would be given by the focus properties of the XFEL beam, which is actually quite adventurous. For coherence properties, you would focus on the X-ray beam to a focal spot of 1 to 2 microns. And due to the very to the KB focusing system, you can get a very long line focus in the X-rays. So you can typically create a focal volume of 2-3 centimeters in length. And this gives you a very nice aspect ratio, which would sort of guarantee that the X-ray laser you would pump might have actually transverse coherence. So in order to evaluate the gain of this laser, I was solving rate equations for calculating the population dynamics of the upper and lower lasing state. So I show here the small signal gain cross section as a function of time, and the small signal gain cross section is basically the difference between the population in the upper lasing state and the lower lasing state, weighted with the cross section for simulated simulated absorption and emission. The wonderful thing here is, X-ray lasers were basically tried to be realized 15 to 20 years back with hot solid state plasmas. The advantage we have here actually is we're working in a gas. We're working in a gas phase, and we're working with a cold plasma. So this drives the simulated emission cross-section up, because the simulated cross-section basically goes like one over the width of the transition we're driving. The width of a laser is basically determined only by the lifetime broadening of the upper lasing state, which is given by the Auger decay in our case. So we would have a relative width of 3 × 10⁻⁴ in this system. And the Doppler broadening is at room temperature, basically, and it's very small as compared to the natural width. So shown here is here the gain cross-section as a function of time now. And what you see, if you just plot these level populations for the level inversions for different states, is that you might be able to exploit lasing from different lines in neon. So as a function of time, you create a core hole in neon, single core hole, which is decaying on a time scale of 2 femtosecond, and you get a gain cross section of around one atomic unit, with a duration of 2 to 3 femtoseconds, basically. What happens after the Auger decay process, you end up with neon 3 plus in the ground state. You might kick up another electron, which actually creates you another core hole in neon 3 plus, and this population version might give you a lasing process too. So you can get basically a positive gain for this neon 3 plus transition, and you actually see here also a very small gain of neon 2 plus, and this gain curve basically results from a lasing transition into a double core hole you were creating with the LCLS. So if you really have high enough intensities, you kick out sequentially two electrons from the K shell, you create this double hole, and you basically get this positive gain on this lasing transition. And in order to try to saturate your lasing transition, you have to basically try to tune the gas density in order to get a gain length product, which is saturating in transition. So the intensity is going to grow as the exponential of this signal gain cross-section times the density times the length of the amplifying medium. So basically, the length is given by the focus. Focus length you can achieve with this KB focusing system. And to saturate, you need a gain length product of around 20, which gives you an atomic density of 10 to the 18 atoms per cc. So we are talking about pressures of one atmosphere. So in order to determine the temporal output of the laser, you have to try to study self-consistent gain in this lasing system. And I was doing this with a scalar model, basically treating the flux of the LCLS propagating through the matter through the neon gas and also the X-ray lasing line created in the neon gas as just as an intensity flux. So I'm not really solving any Maxwell equations. And I have to keep track of the population of the upper and the lower lasing state. So I basically couple the propagation of the flux through this gas volume to the occupation. And I'm doing this by having a traveling window, basically traveling through this gas volume with the pump pulse itself. And I'm treating valence ionization. I'm treating core ionization, Auger decay, simulated emission, simulated absorption, and other losses through ionization of the levels. And so you can basically determine how this flux is created. And since the SLS pulse is propagating in one direction, you actually get only flux generated in one direction. So here's shown the expected output as a function of the interaction length. Shown here is the peak intensity, which is determined by the focal spot of the LCLS laser pulse, of the pumping laser pulse. And you see that it grows. It's a logarithmic plot. It grows exponentially. So you might expect some exponential gain. And at some point, it starts to saturate. Counting the photons in the beam, it's a little bit optimistic in this 1D model, but you might be able to have 10 to the 9 photons in the beam, pumping with typical SLS parameters of 5 times 10 to the 12 photons. And so the intensity at the output plasma column would correspond to 10 to the 16 to 10 to the 17 watts per square centimeter. And more interesting, you may be able to create very, very short pulses. So you would start out with a self-seeding, basically, with a spontaneous emission, which is the time duration is given by the time duration of the gain. In this specific sample, it would be roughly one femtosecond. And during the exponential growth, you actually are decreasing the pulse length. So as soon as you saturate, you can only amplify the tails of the pulse, and the pulse gets broadened again. So you see here the pulse duration is a function of the interaction length, and you might get sub femtosecond pulses in the X-ray regime. Oops. And this sort of laser, you're basically trying to pumping with a chaotic source, so it has not very it's still somehow chaotic. So it depends on the intensity structure of the pump. Your gain is very sensitive to it, and at some point you might be able to have gains of different lasing lines with similar altitude. So you basically could try to amplify both lasing transitions in a single shot with this setup. And shown is here the number of photons in these different lasing lines as a function of length. So you could you start out by amplifying transitions in neon 1 plus and neon 3 plus until at some point you get saturated. So you basically stop the gain of both lasing lines. And observing a lasing transition in neon 2 plus, you actually see that at some point, as soon as your lasing lasing transition saturates, the gain kicks up of another line, and you start to saturate a transition in neon 2 plus. And the reason for this is that at saturation, your level dynamics actually changes, the level kinetic changes. So as long as you are in the exponential gain regime, the kinetics is determined by Auger decay. So you start out, you basically have the Auger decay, and you amplify the transition of neon 1 plus and neon 3 plus. But at saturation, you have simulated emission is so strong to basically drive the level kinetics. And you're going down by a radiative process. You create a hole in neon 2 plus by core ionization, which creates you this gain in neon 2 plus, actually. So shown here, the gain cross-section is a function of the interaction length. So you have this gas volume, and depending on where you sit in the gas volume, you will have different atomic kinetics happening. And you and calculating this in this simple one-dimensional self-consistent gain model, you can see what sort of pulses you could create. And for this specific pulse, you actually create a pulse peak of 850 eV, containing 10 to the 10 photons, followed by the other lasing transitions with light of 860 and 855 EVs. They are not completely saturated, but they still should contain a considerable amount of photons. So what you could create in this way is a sort of a pump probe source. You see you have a time difference in the peaks of these pumps, which is around 2-3 femtoseconds. And your pulses are in the femtosecond, have femtosecond duration. The thing is not reproducible. That's the problem, because you're basically pumping with a chaotic source, and the small signal gain structure depends on the pump pulse very critically. But it might be nevertheless probably useful to try to explore these sort of pulses for pump probe settings, for X-ray pump probe settings and multicolor experiments. From a theory point of view, that's not the whole truth of the thing. It's a very simplistic model. It's a 1D model. It's a scalar model for the electric field, for the flux. So in order to really determine the spectrum of the radiation, in order to determine coherence properties, study propagation effects and refraction in this long plasma volume, what you actually would have to solve is the Maxwell-Bloch equations. Coupled Maxwell-Bloch equations. But before I'm doing this, we're going to do an experiment at the LCLS, and it's scheduled for September. So we have basically we're going to use the LCLS beam. We're going to focus it in the AMO chamber, where we filled a gas cell with extendable length, and we are providing an X-ray spectrometer in the second hatch, in the SXR hatch, where we actually want to observe the lasing lines and see if we can observe all these different lines we were predicting. So I'm going back to my introductory slide, and the next topic I want to talk about is the Rabi flopping in the X-ray regime. So I'm referring to an experiment Linda Young, and in a big collaboration was doing at the SLS. But basically, the resonant Auger effect was studied. So the SLS was tuned to a resonant transition from 1s to 3p, and the intensities principle would be high enough to drive Rabi oscillations between these two levels, and the Auger electron resulting from a spectator Auger decay process would have knowledge about the Rabi oscillations, or the spectrum would be changed by this nonlinear coupling of these two levels. And I'm going to discuss two different schemes and two different methods we actually need to describe this. So for this very simple system to start out with, we can describe the system in a wave function approach. You could describe the system by only a very few numbers of relevant states. You have the ground state of the neon atom, and you have the single core excited state of basically 1s to 3p state excited. And you have all the states you couple with the Coulomb operator. Basically, you couple to all the decay channel states. So you have you can expand the wave function in a continuum of the single electron Auger wave functions. And in this restricted space, you can derive equations, Bloch equations for the coefficients in this expansion. So basically, these are the Bloch Bloch equations for this very, very simple model. And you can, in this way, calculate the Auger electron spectrum. So what you have basically here is the transition is just coupled by the Rabi frequency, which is basically linear in the electric field and the transition matrix element. You include a decay mechanism for Auger decay, which is given by this decay time here. And the interesting thing is actually that you can calculate the system, you can calculate the Auger electron spectrum by just looking at the level populations of your ion. Okay. So basically, the Auger electron spectrum is just given as an integral over the coefficient for the upper lasing state. So if you have high enough intensity, you can actually drive these Rabi oscillations in the system. And these Rabi oscillations will have an imprint on the Auger electron spectrum. So shown is here the Auger electron spectrum as a function of the energy around the peak for a coherent Gaussian pulse. And you see that you are developing something like a splitting of the line and then very, very regular structures. People know these structures in theory from resonance fluorescence in the optical regime. And if you use these very chaotic LCLS pulses to drive your thing, you basically get in the case of low intensity, you get a very, very spiky Auger electron pattern for a single shot. And for high intensity, you see a considerable broadening of the spectrum. So if you sample over 10,000 sample shots of the LCLS in theory and you calculate your spectrum, you observe the Lorentzian for the low intensity case, that's what you're used to. And in the high intensity case, you actually would see a broadening of the spectrum. And this was most probably seen in this first experiment. The case is a little bit different if you go to different transition. So in another experiment, basically what was done was to tune the LCLS to the 1S to P transition in neon. So you had you use the LCLS beam to first valence ionize your system and then drive your system in the hole you were creating by valence ionization. And so here you have to deal with an open quantum system because you start out with a system with 10 electrons. You remove one electron by valence ionization. This process might not be coherent. And then you have a coherent coupling of this process. So you can no longer describe this system by wave function approach, but you have to go to density matrices. So you have to try to derive the density matrix system for this system. And then that's still pretty forward for this small system, but I'm showing you a proposal for another experiment, but this might not be very easy anymore. And basically, I'm coming to the to another proposal for resonant Raman scattering in the X regime, where you would excite the core level to an unoccupied valence level. And you could either observe a fluorescence, Raman scattering from another electron. So it would be some sort of spectator process, or the same electron you were exciting would radiate down. In this way, you end up with a core or valence excited state in a shell hole. In this case, you would end up only with a valence excited state without inner shell holes. So coming back to neon, you could think about tuning neon to a resonance in helium-like neon. And this state might be, from the level population, this state might be heavily populated in your system. You could tune from 1s to 3p in the helium-like neon and create basically a double excited state. But in order to produce the helium-like neon, you have all sort of different processes you have to go through. You start out with neon complete neon, and then you have all sort of Auger decay processes, photonization processes. And then in order to study resonant Raman scattering, you really need to know the density matrix of the system here you're creating as a function of time. So it's going to be very difficult to do this by deriving the Bloch equations for your density matrix. The interesting thing here is that you might be even able to have something like a non-resonant Raman effect here, a non-linear Raman effect, because you really couple these levels strongly. And similarly, in the Auger effect, you might have imprints of this non-linear coupling onto your Raman scattered light. So basically, you create this double excited state, and this double excited state can decay in two mechanisms. You can have a decay from the 2p to the 1s shell, giving you basically two X-ray photons, or you can have a decay of this spectator electron down to the 2s, giving you a VV photon and an X-ray photon. And if you drive this transition very strong, you could completely quench this this pathway. So you might be able to really control the quantum pathway of the system by the intensity of the pump source you're using. So this might be a very interesting experiment to do. But for doing this, we need to develop some new theory, I think. And I want to put out that I hope I could find people interested in working on a stochastic wave function approach within the next 3 weeks to try to solve this system. So there are basically two approaches. You can try to calculate a density matrix and find ways in order to propagate a density matrix of the system. Or you can probably adopt a stochastic wave function approach from quantum optics. And that's what I think would be something we should look into. And you can sample the ionic reduced density matrix of the system by just sampling an ensemble of pure states, which are undergoing quantum jumps. So you have basically deterministic parts of evoluting your wave packet, which would describe the resonant interaction of the XFEL with your atoms. And you have these stochastic processes like a photoionization or Auger decay and so on. And the question is how you could derive these quantum jump operators. Would there be a possibility, for instance, to start out from a semi-classical approximation and try to calculate this from a semi-classical approximation, or starting from perturbation theory, for instance? And you could test this on the single atom case very, very easily, like the case for the resonant Auger effect, for instance. You could compare the full Bloch equations for the density matrix with this quantum jump approach. And once you have settled this, I mean, you might be able to treat more complex systems. And I would like to acknowledge my collaborators. I'm very happy to having found a team of experimentalists, actually, who are going to do the experiment at the LCLS. I'm working in Livermore. I'm working with James Dunn, Felicity Albert, Sébastien Lepape, and Alexander Graf. I'm collaborating with Jorge Roca from Colorado State University, and his two PhD students, Punk and Ryan and Mike Purvis, and with his like people. And I also would like to acknowledge the collaboration on the theory project with Robin Santra. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you, Nina. So the session is open for questions. Yes.
Hello. Okay. very interesting talk first. And I would like to ask about this resonant Raman scattering. Mm-hmm. There was a study recently of a three-level model also, and the propagation in a longer medium, and this, exactly this quenching was investigated also in the context of lasing without inversion. Mm-hmm. That was Galmukhanov, Jichai, Liu, and so on. What way is this related or different?
Well, it's a different regime. I mean, it was a VV regime in principle. I mean, it's just okay. We have shorter pulses, but it's in principle very, very similar. I mean, from the scheme. But we are dealing here with more levels. So we start out from. I mean, you first have to build up your initial state basically by all sort of quantum processes which are basically incoherent. But in principle, I mean, you could start out. It was a very simple model. It was three level model
coupled
to
lambda
one sort of one linear Maxwell equation.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Other question? No. I Jan Michael.
I was wondering what you had in mind with your semi-classical approximations or approaches to.
Yeah, I mean, I was also thinking about solid state processes. I mean, you could think about models like you did in high harmonic generation for describing, I mean, a coherent process. So I was wondering if you could try to study the backscattering of electrons to atoms, for instance, and assuming a plane wave, and then try to see what are sort of excitations you get, and starting from a semi-classical approximation. I mean, for having a quantum path, basically, you would design to a classical electron in your medium.
But you're talking about X-rays, no?
Yeah, but it's just like, I mean, you would have... you wouldn't have the X-rays coupled to the dynamics, but you would. If you are in a solid, you would have collisions, and basically the dynamics would be driven by Coulomb forces.
You would follow the ionized electrons classically and see.
I didn't put this in there. That would be a second step for the solid state, basically.
Okay.
Peter.
Did I understand that the first part of your talk, you had in mind X-ray lasing by creating inversion, correct?
By photolization, yeah. So it's a
yeah. Okay. Now there is a subculture in physics called X-ray lasers creating inversion in plasmas, which has been going on for.
Exactly,
30
yeah.
or 40 years now, okay?
But they have a difference. They have a
yeah,
difference.
So what is the new twist that you are...
Okay, so I mean, the idea of an ionization-driven X-ray laser, where you would create a pump source in the X-ray regime, and then try to efficiently create an inner shell electron by ionization, was already put forward by Rentzepis, I think, in the 60s. The scheme was even tried, but it was never realized, so it was never really shown. That was sort of that's exactly the same scheme I'm proposing here, but I'm using the XFELO pump. And on the other hand, you have collisional X-ray laser schemes where you basically populate or you create inversion by
sure.
recombination
sure.
of electrons in the
yeah.
excited state. And the big difference here is they work in very hot plasmas. Of high density, high mm-hmm. collision plasmas, mm-hmm. they have, broadening effects that they typically collisionally broadened, stark broadened, Doppler broadening by the high temperatures they have.
Basically what they get is thermal light, except, I don't think they get
they
a
get
laser,
a
really, but...
They get
never.
A transition into, they would get a transition, yeah.
yeah
I mean,
it's
not thermal light, but it's a lasing transition, but it's a different scheme.
Yeah.
The thing is, I have here a high gain scheme, because I'm working with a cold mm-hmm. atomic gas, and that's mm-hmm. a big difference. That my gain is 4 orders of magnitude higher what they usually have in their plasma driven lasing sources, X-ray lasing sources.
Mm. Other questions? Well. I have not a question, really a comment. I like very much the idea to see a Molo triplet in the X-ray regime. That would be. Do you think it's really there? They will do it soon, or it's just?
I wouldn't be able to resolve it with the spectrometer I have available. I mean, we're working at 1 kV, and
yeah.
It's not so easy really to get the resolution. I mean, I want uh-huh. to cover the whole spectrum from to see all my lasing lights from 850 eV to 1.4 kV.
Mm-hmm.
And then to get our energy resolution is 6 eV, 6, 7 eV. So that's probably just the limit in order to see
okay.
the, see see the splitting?
Well, the other question. Oh.
What would you learn?
Oh, Peter, come on. No, it's an achievement, I mean, because this has been done only in the optical range. Now there is... Oh, I thought it was... Yeah. In resonance fluorescence.
I mean, kind of an interesting thing is that these multi-peak structures, they have not even been observed in the optical domain. I'm not talking about the Mahler triplets, I'm talking about these multi-ring structures which can have 7, 8...
That's another thing.
I mean, that's a completely different thing. And
okay.
It seems like this is... Yeah, and I'm just I'm saying that interestingly, even in the optical domain or more in the typical laser wavelength domain, these multi-peak structures have never been seen. So this is, for example, something that has only been predicted and not even been reproduced in the optical domain. I'm not sure it's easier to do with X-rays, but the multi-peak structures are difficult to see. I think one reason why they're difficult to see in experiment is because you typically deal with volume averaging effects. So in other words, each point in space has a different multi-peak structure and then you average over all that. But
that's not what I thought. Yeah. So my question is,
no, but I'm not even sure why you're talking about Mahler triplets, because Nina didn't show Mahler triplets.
I was mistaken. Mean, yeah. Okay.
It's related to this talk, but essentially she was not talking about Mahler triplets.
Okay.
These multi-peak structures are different. And
so
I... prongs than three in general. Mm-hmm. And so even this has never been seen, except for calculations like Nina's and Levenstein saw that, I guess, 20 years ago. So I think that's even a fundamental, simple thing that's never been observed. Whether you can actually see this kind of multi-peak structure in an electron spectrum.
I mean, the created laser line would have similar spectrum. I mean, so fluorescence or Auger decay, I mean, in the end, the spectrum is going to be very, very similar. So the same features should be in both the case.
Okay, so let's move on to the next talk, if there are any further comments. Thank you.